For those of you who are absolutely new to Buddhist practice, tonight's talk is going to be a little bit heavy because I'm giving a talk on one of the more dense topics of the Buddha, but if you can follow along, if you have your thinking caps on, it'll be worthwhile because this subject is where the Buddha talks about how stress and misery and discomfort arises in our life. It's sort of a very fundamental talk, and it's it gives an enormous amount of insight into our day-to-day experience when we understand this topic. It's called dependent arising, and I'm not going to go into detail of all the steps involved, because it's actually pretty lengthy. I'm just going to cut to the most important core elements of the teaching and why, more importantly, it's worth bearing in mind. So, at the very start of this teaching, the Buddha states that, by default, human beings have an almost pre-programmed tendency to look for security, happiness, meaning, safety, everything externally. When we're young and when we're infants, of course, when we're cold, somebody provides us with a blanket. When we're hungry, we're fed. When we're thirsty, we're given something to drink. Generally, any discomfort that arises within us is addressed externally, and generally via other people, by our interacting with others. So we have this, from infancy on, we have this programming to look for the solutions to everything externally. When we feel lonely, the predisposition is to find someone to talk with or be with. When we feel scared, we look for something external to provide security. When we feel angry, we look for somebody to vent it on or to listen as we vent. When we feel frustrated, we might want to pound on something. So whenever an emotional state arises, the tendency is, I'm going to address it out there in the world. I'm going to find someone or something that will allow me to, you know, get it out of me, get the feelings out. Of course, a lot of our emotional states and feelings cannot be addressed externally. So as we go around and we look through the world, sometimes experiences are scary, or people are scary, or we have bad encounters. And when that happens, we form associations. For instance, when you're young and you go to school and the other kids are mean, you might even feel not a part of, and some of the kids are bullying, you'll basically note all the sensory impressions about those kids and tag that as uncomfortable. I don't like this. I don't like the way these people look. I'm going to remember that. This is a association that's done by an unconscious part of the brain called the amygdala. As we go on through life, we have an accumulation of objects and things that we just have assumed are bad from our experience. Sometimes they really are dangerous. For example, we have a somewhat default fear of snakes and bears. But then we also will associate things that aren't really that bad. For example, suppose somebody who's got brown hair and wears thick glasses shouts at you when you're young. Well, believe it or not, not only that will that person be triggered or associated as being dangerous, but just the qualities of having brown hair and thick glasses and whatever they're wearing will also be tagged, because this part of the brain, the amygdala, is not very smart. If you're in a car crash and you're listening to the Butthole Surfers, favorite band, the next time you hear the Butthole Surfers, you'll get a unconscious reaction. Even though the bottle surface hopefully did not cause your car crash. That's called neural triggering. So this is where the important point of the crucial point of the teaching arises. The Buddha said, as we go through the world and we see things, certain things will trigger gut feelings. If we see something that in the past we've associated with danger, we'll get a tightness in the muscles, we'll become contracted. If we see something that has brought ease or a sense of security or a sense of comfort in the past, we'll experience a sense of muscle and unconscious ease. Now, the important thing to note is that this happens before you're consciously aware. Before you have any awareness of how you think about something, you already have an unconscious priming. Your body is already reacting to things. Now, how does this work? The Buddha proposed this 2,400 years before the next psychologist got around to noticing, a guy named William James in the turn of the 1900s. He noticed that when you're walking through the woods and you see something that looks like a snake, you'll have a startle response even before you think, oh my God, that's a snake. You're already jumping in the air. And he proposed that we have this unconscious priming that predates our conscious awareness of anything. And then, let's jump forward another 70 years, and a neurologist named Benjamin Labette, when he was doing studies, people undergoing brain operations, he attached sensors. And he, through a series of experiments, detected that before we come up with any idea to act, there's already an unconscious urge that he noted in parts of the body. We're already priming to act before we have the idea. So unconsciously, before we even are aware of what we want to do, what we want to think, how we want to act, there's already mechanisms priming us. And then a few years later, Damasio discovered the same thing. He actually put sensors on card players' hands, and he discovered that before card players are aware of when to hold or when to stay or hold, I don't know, accept or fold. Yeah. Fold or bet. Let's use that. Fold or bet. I don't remember the exact, but he discovered that they're already unconsciously aware of what to do before they become consciously aware. And then after that, the great neuroscientist Joseph Ledoux discovered the final proof that we have two neural circuitries, circuit paths. There's a fast one that goes directly from the amygdala to the nervous system. And so if the amygdala thinks anything is bad or dangerous, it causes us to tense and get ready to fight, flight, or freeze. On the other hand, if the amygdala associates something as good, it triggers us to relax. So underlying every experience we have, there's this message that the body is relaying to us, which is, I don't like this, I do like this, or I don't have a fucking opinion about this whatsoever. That's the only three things the nervous system is capable of communicating. Like, dislike, don't have an opinion. And this is going on before you become consciously aware of something. If you grab a pan that's really hot, you've already dropped it by the time you've become aware that that pan is hot and you think you decide to drop it. It's already happened. Consciousness happens about a half second after all sensory information arrives to the brain. On the other hand, the amygdala and the fast circuit only takes about 10 one-thousandths of a second. So there's a big period between when your body has become tense and when consciousness is caught up with it. So what does this mean is that we've already got a lot of predispositions arising before we even think about something. At this point, the Buddha went on to say, from that, we have a basic impulse to like what feels good and to dislike what feels bad. This is not a huge jump. I hope you can follow it. So if you feel good, you'll think, oh, this thing is good. We translate the body feeling good into thinking the thing in front of us is good. If somebody we're introduced to reminds you of somebody that you liked in the past, you'll get that ease. And you're like, ooh, I like this person. I don't know why, but they're good. On the other hand, if somebody reminds you of a schmuck or a fascist in your previous years, I don't like the looks of this. I'll give you an example. When I was a young punk in college in Oberlin, I would get drunk all the time, and I would inevitably get into fights with the swim team. For some reason, me and the swim team, boy, did we hate each other. Those jocks and me did not get along. And from that point on, whenever I would be introduced to somebody who looked like one of those fucking fascist jocks, now I'm sure they're fine. But whenever I would introduce to anybody that looks like a jock, I would get this, like, the shoulders would go up, the belly would go up, the jaw would clench, the forehead muscles would contract, and be like, eh! And then my mind would be racing to figure out why I didn't like him. I'll figure it out soon enough why this person is an asshole. Just give me a little while. And that's literally what the great neurologist Benjamin Libet said. He said that consciousness thinks that it's coming up with the reasons why we dislike something. But actually, most of the time, all consciousness is doing is justifying an association we've already made. And the problem is, a lot of these associations we've made are not true. Like the example with the butthole service in the car, or just the fact that I dislike somebody who looks like a jock in the past, right? These are not good things to follow. So when you hear somebody say, follow your gut, you tell them, no, because my gut's not always right. For example, the writer Malcolm Gladwell, who writes sort of summaries of neuroscience, he wrote a book called The Tipping Point. But he noted in the book that in our culture, we have a lot of racism, we have a lot of misogyny, we have a lot of gender expectations, and these beliefs creep into our unconscious associations. So, for example, if you're walking down the street and you've been taught all your life to beware of people of color, or you've seen on TV depictions of people of color as being dangerous, then you're walking down the street and you see a few people of color, there might be an unconscious predisposition to tense. And at that point, your mind might follow up with, oh shit, I'm in trouble. The association is not true. It's not real. It's not valid. It's just something that's been programmed in by too much TV or, things that you've been taught. But we tend to trust and follow our gut. From this point on, the Buddha said we have, if it feels good, I like it. If it doesn't feel good, I don't like it. And then from that point on, the whole realm of suffering explodes, because from that simple thought, a whole nest of self-centered cogitation arises, which are, for example, you see a pair of shoes, and the shoes trigger a sense of positive associations, because you've seen shoes like that on somebody that you liked or you thought was a good person. You want those shoes. The thought, I want those shoes, arises. And from that comes the thought, I never get what I want. This is terrible. Everybody else gets the shoes that they want, but me, never. I'm going to splurge because I work so hard. Blah, blah, blah. So what just has happened is, from the initial like to the statement of want, now there's a mass of ideas flowing through the mind. Let's look at the exact opposite case. You're introduced to somebody have a negative association with, then you have the thought, I don't like this person. Then the brain races to come up with justifications of why you want to stay away. In general, this is what creates the purest form of suffering, because from the body to the mind, we've now created a mass of tension. The body is tense, the mind is filling up with thoughts, and what we're doing is we're reassociating this thing with being dangerous and bad. So we're hardwiring each time we attach thoughts and mental agitation to an initial physical dislike. We're hardwiring that. We're making it more embedded. So if you experience, for example, one time when somebody offered you tofu, a tofu, veggie tofu chicken salad sandwich, and you took a bite and you didn't like it. And the next time, it might be a perfectly good sandwich, but you've already got that association, so the belly tenses and the shoulders go up, and then the thought is, oh, I don't like the looks of this. And then up comes the speech making about tofu and why don't they make what I want? I like real chicken salad. And then what we've done is we've created more stress that's re-tagged tofu chicken. Why the fuck did I use this example? with stress. So you're neurally re-ingraining and re-hardwiring, and it becomes a feedback loop. Trigger, thought, stress, reassociate, and that's what a lot of life becomes. For example, avoidance strategies. Somebody who, the very basic foundations of agoraphobia start when somebody has a negative experience outdoors, and they come racing back in, and they feel safe in their house. The next time they go outside, they have a negative feeling that arises. They become tense. They start to have a panic attack. At this point, they have two choices. They can sit with the panic attack, breathe and relax, or B, they can run back inside and reassociate being outside with being dangerous. The more we give into the avoidance technique, the more we re-tag, the more we create more and more associations until people wind up literally hiding indoors rather than going out and living full lives. So the Buddha stated that there's a way out. There's a way out. We can escape this chain of suffering. He said that right after feeling arises, there's an opportunity to break the chain and to intervene. And this was subsequently proposed by the neurologists Benjamin Libet and Damasio and all the other neuroscientists. Basically, the idea goes like this. You're in a situation in life where you get this gut feeling that you don't like something. And you feel it, and then the mind wants to go into the story about why it's bad, why you should get out, what's wrong. Before you do that, there's an opportunity to stop and keep your awareness on the body sensations and just observe and just watch them arise and pass without acting to avoid or to attach to something we like, without trusting the gut feeling. We sit and we simply observe it. And we can even, if we need to think something, we just add the thought, you know, okay, this is dislike. This is what dislike feels like. If we fall into the tendency of, ah, shit, this is awful, this situation, what happens is we pull our awareness from the gut feelings and we get lost in the thought and we're off into suffering. But if we keep the awareness in the body, then what we can do after we watch the initial dislike arise is we can relax and breathe and soften and slowly begin to dismantle. Even with panic attacks, if we extend the out-breath, we and and really make the in-breaths very full, we can trip what's known as the vagus nerve, which releases serotonin and will stop a panic attack. So if we stay physically aware and observe what's happening in the body, we can actually stop ourselves from being pushed around. When Libet studied how feelings come about before thought, he did say that there is a role for consciousness. He says that consciousness comes in right after the feelings arrive, but before we act. So even though we have this impulse to act, to run, to avoid, or to give into eating something, we have this moment where we can override it and say no. He called this consciousness' true role is the veto power. We don't actually have any role in determining our initial likes and dislikes and predispositions, but we do have an opportunity to stop ourselves before we speak, before we act. He, in his witticism, said, we don't have free will, we have free wounds. That's a neuroscience joke for you. So basically, the role of consciousness, he used another metaphor, which is consciousness is like a monkey riding on the back of an elephant. The elephant is the body and the unconscious. Consciousness is that monkey. The monkey thinks it's steering the elephant and making the decisions. In fact, most of the decisions are done by the elephant, who's just racing around. And the monkey's claiming credit for everything. But if the monkey really sees something that's terribly wrong, it can slap the elephant on the head and get it to stop for a second. So your consciousness, I guess I'm saying, is like a monkey slapping an elephant on the head. You actually do have the capability to intervene. And when we intervene, what we do is we develop tolerance. Because even though everything is pushing us into that feeling of, I've got to get out of here, this is uncomfortable, I don't like this, we can actually begin to learn how to work with the breath and relaxing the body like we did in our meditation so that we can expand our comfort zone. When you think about it, everything in life that's new, we almost invariably have that I don't like this feeling. When I was 45, was the first time I got on a skateboard. And when you're 45 and there's 10-year-olds whizzing by you and laughing at you, I guarantee you there's gut feelings of dislike going on. Every single part of my body was not liking the experience. And following from that, my brain was saying, yeah, this really sucks. The last thing I need right now is to have some 10-year-old little, you know, totalitarian schmuck laugh at me as they whiz by me. But instead of listening to that, I kept bringing my awareness back and breathing and relaxing the body. When I used to have this tendency of getting, when I would go to doctor's offices, because when I was young, I for some reason associated doctor's offices with being bad. So when I go to doctor's office, I become hypertense. And I would sometimes get these readings, like I had high blood pressure. And after a while, they said, you know, there's nothing about you that suggests high blood pressure, but you're getting these readings. So I decided before I would go in that I would meditate and relax and breathe and really concentrate on making the body comfortable. And then I went in and all the high blood pressure readings went away. It was literally just priming the body. The sympathetic nervous system was being triggered by the amygdala telling me that being in a doctor's office was dangerous and bad. So rather than giving in and allowing the thoughts to flow from that and turning my life into an avoidance of ever going to a doctor, I intervened and just trained myself how to be comfortable while I was doing something that's necessary in life. This is the core to becoming comfortable when there's phobias in life. If you go to a cognitive behavioral therapist and you have a fear of heights, what they're going to do is they're going to put you in the elevator with them. They're going to bring you up to the top floor. When the elevator opens, they'll just stand there with you. They won't force you to the edge and hold you over and say, look, what's the matter with you, you schmuck? You should be able to... No, they'll just stand there and they'll tell you then to breathe. Because what you're doing when you breathe and relax is you're overriding the trigger that this is bad. You're softening the muscles and you're telling the amygdala that it's okay what you're doing. This is fascinating. When people go through car accidents in Sweden, they gave them they put them through this clinical trial where they gave some of the people beta blockers right after the accident, which stopped having that autonomic nervous system physical reaction. And they found that just by doing this, they could stop people from having negative associations. But the ones that they didn't give the beta blockers to, because the physical associations would arise in the future, those people went on to have panic attacks. The ones that were given the beta blockers stopping the initial physical response didn't. It's simply by following your gut and allowing the reassociations to tag that we create avoidance and we create stress in life. So if we can remember when we feel that overwhelming urge to flee, assuming you're not in actual danger, by the way. You know, if there's a person with a knife or a scary situation, get the fuck out. But in most situations, when you're just in a situation that causes discomfort, with me, it's getting my files ready for my taxes. I sit and I breathe and I stop the circuit, because I'll tell you what the circuit will do. I'll get tense when I sit to do my taxes and I'll want to avoid it, and I'll get tense, and then the thought will rise, wouldn't it be better to check what's going on Facebook right now? And then the body relaxes because it likes that a fuck of a lot more than my taxes. And it's already priming me to do the avoidance rather than do the thing that's useful. So if I can intervene and stop right there and observe the stress, observe the dislike in the body, breathe, relax it, treat it with compassion, then the ultimate result is equanimity, which means we can live a balanced life doing, walking through the things that in the past we previously were terrified of and uncomfortable with. Again, most of the time, our gut associations are not actually based on anything that's real. They're based on a whole host of associations we've simply picked up and come to accept as fact. So, that's the ultimate core message in Dependent Co-Rising, that there's liberation and freedom from our pre-programming available to us, and it involves compassionately staying present with the body. If you can just remember that, I think you'll have walked away with something worthwhile tonight. So I thank you for listening, and now turn on